I'm going to call the State Government Finance Committee to order for Wednesday, February 28th. First things first, Representative Lilly, would you did you have a chance to review the minutes from yesterday?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move the minutes from yesterday.
Okay, all in favor?
Aye.
Those are approved. We are going to move on. We're going to have the legislative auditor's report, special review of Metropolitan Council finance transit activity. So as we begin moving that forward, we'll speak slowly, waiting for Chair Anderson to get here. But go ahead, come to the table, introduce yourself for the record, and here she is now. So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and oh, I've just been told that we're not going to do that. Minutes have been
approved.
And I apologize, members, for being late. This is why I rely on Shirley so much. She helps keep me on task, but she was down here doing her due diligence. So, members, I first want to start off with the leftover business that we had from yesterday regarding the money side of it on the state auditor, and I think that Ms. Roberts has prepared a document for us. So I first want to clean up yesterday's business and then move from there. So, Ms. Roberts, in your packets, everybody, you should have the payment history. Ms. Roberts, can you walk us through that, please?
Madam Chair, members, the payment history shows the payments that are in the SWIFT accounting system for the payments from the state auditor to the law firm representing that office. And you can see that the last payment showing up in the accounting system is from December 8th of 2016, and the total amount is $251,788. This is the same information that was presented to this committee last session. So as far as the accounting system information, nothing has changed.
And Ms. Roberts, if I remember correctly, the reason that we're in limbo is that the law firm representing the state auditor is not billing us unless they win.
Madam Chair, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay, so okay. And if we had the auditor's staff here, they'd be able to answer that. But I know that they are unwilling to come to the committee. That's my understanding. And if that is the case, do we have any ballpark figure? This goes back to 2016, of what the amount would be with the last billing date of 2016, not including the appeals. Do we know how much money that would be? Ms. Roberts.
Again, I have not discussed this with the state auditor's office. I think they would have to respond to that.
Okay. Members, any other questions on this piece at all? All right. We'll try and get some more answers on this and send a letter to the state auditor again asking for more details. Okay. And members, we are going to go next to SHPO. Mr. Nobles, if you can give the OLA report on that. Welcome to the committee again. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor, and it's good to be back with you. Madam Chair and members, almost exactly a year ago, the governor, March 2017, recommended that the legislature enact legislation that would transfer the State Historical Preservation Office from the Minnesota Historical Society to the Department of Administration. There were two brief information hearings on proposals, legislation to put that transfer into effect. And not much more happened until the omnibus state government finance bill and provisions, as the chair certainly knows, were put into that omnibus bill, which mandated the transfer effective March 15, 2018. And so it has been in process. In that legislation, you also asked the Office of Legislative Auditor to evaluate SHPO, and SHPO is the State Historic Preservation Office. Frankly, we did not have the staff resources to do that full comprehensive evaluation. But since there was very brief hearings on that proposal, and I think many people were surprised that the transfer was mandated, I thought it would be helpful to do a brief report that explained why the governor made that recommendation and why the legislature enacted the legislation. I think I also felt it was important to do because I think we would all agree that the Minnesota Historical Society is really one of our premier private nonprofit organizations. I'm sure many of you have had opportunities to visit their historic sites, probably go over to the History Center from time to time, and I think we would all agree that we are very proud that in this state we have one of the really first-class historical societies in the nation. And so it was a bit of a surprise that the governor would recommend that the legislature would enact legislation that seemed negative in that it took something away from the Historical Society, and particularly surprising since you were taking away the State Historical Preservation Office, which sort of logically you would think fits in the Historical Society. And so I felt like it would be helpful to do this report and explain, again, why the governor made that recommendation, why the legislature enacted it. And I won't go too deep into details, but just to say a few things as background. You have, over the years, given many state responsibilities and functions to the Historical Society. They are the custodian of state records. They keep the state archive. And so it was not surprising that after the Congress enacted the National Historic Preservation Act in 1966. Shortly thereafter, you delegated to the Historical Society the responsibility to set up a SHPO and to take responsibility for implementing the programs under that federal legislation. And they had a wide variety of responsibilities under that federal law. And I detail those in the appendix, let's see, I think it's Appendix C. And you will see there, and that's on page 23, that the SHPO had a wide range of responsibilities, and I won't go through those in detail, and they have some responsibilities under state law as well. And they have had these responsibilities for decades without really much controversy. And so, again, you come back to the question, what happened? Well, if you look at number 9, that's really what became controversial. And if you read that, that SHPO was to consult with appropriate federal agencies on federal undertakings, and those are just projects that have some connection with the federal government, they may that may affect a historic property, then SHPO was to provide advice and consultation to federal agencies. And so, again, that sounds fairly benign. Like, how could they get into trouble for offering advice and consultation? Well, it really came down to two projects that became controversial, where they were giving advice to a federal, two federal agencies, actually, about projects that were going to affect some historic properties. Those two projects, both in northern Minnesota, one, the Polymet Mine Project, which I'm sure you've all heard a lot about, and then another project that was going to expand the what is called the Chickwack Museum, which was a fishing resort for many years but was then taken over by the U.S. Forest Service and then became a museum. And not that many years ago, it became so popular that they needed to expand. And so both of those projects required what is referred to as a Section 106 review. And that's basically what this paragraph 9 is. It's called in the world of historic preservation a 601 review. And basically it just says that a federal project where the federal government is involved, the federal agencies that have some responsibility have to take into account what impact those projects are going to have on historic properties. And if there are going to be adverse impacts, they need to find a way to either eliminate them or mitigate them, if at all possible. And along the way through a Section 601 review, they get advice from SHPO, whether it's the Minnesota SHPO or if it's in Missouri, there's a Missouri SHPO, or in California, there's a California SHPO. Every state has a SHPO to do this consulting and giving advice. So why did SHPO get into trouble by giving advice? Well, the governor said, and a number of legislators said, well, SHPO was slow, and they weren't very responsive to concerns and criticisms that arose along the way. But I think the real reason people were concerned is that they felt that SHPO, this office over in the Historical Society, and remember, the Historical Society is a private, nonprofit organization, was exercising regulatory authority, that they, in effect, had become a decision maker, not just a consultant or advisor, in this 601 process. Now, I looked at the law, I looked at the rules, and I said, no, they don't have ultimate decision-making authority. But many people who had dealt with them said, yes, they do, that a federal agency will not proceed toward giving certification or approval for a project to proceed if it's going to have an adverse effect on historic property without concurrence agreement from the SHPO. That's what people perceived and believed. And so when I talked to the folks at SHPO, they kind of gave that impression too. A number of times they said to me, yes, that's true. Federal agencies have to receive concurrence, agreement from us if the project is going to be finished. We're going to have to agree with what mitigation has to occur. And again, I said to them, that's actually not what the law says. Yes, you have a powerful role. Yes, your advice is required. Yes, normally you are supposed to sign the memorandum of agreement that lays out all of the conditions that have to be met. But there are provisions in the law, in the rules, that say that the federal agency, if they hit a roadblock with a SHPO, they can find other ways to proceed. So again, what I think it came down to is what I said in the conclusion, which is on page two. And this is what I concluded. First of all, we did not conduct a comprehensive evaluation, and so we did not offer an overall conclusion on SHPO's performance. But we do concur that SHPO should be directly accountable to officials in the executive branch of state government based on this conclusion, and that is the judgment that we made that SHPO has assumed de facto decision-making authority in a federal regulatory process that can add costs to a project. So this is one of those situations where perception became reality. And the governor and you said, well, if the perception is, and the reality seems to be, that they are exercising decision-making authority in a federal regulatory process, we need to take them out of this private organization, put them in the Department of Administration, where they will be subject to oversight and accountability to executive officials. So that, Madam Chair, is the conclusion I made, and I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. I think what we're going to do at this point is we're first going to have, if it's Mr. Kelleher or Mr. Elliott that's going to come forward, I'd like to get your response to this. Oh, I didn't see you, Mr. Elliott. I apologize. Have you come forward, and then we'll probably open it up to questions at that point. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Stephen Elliott. I'm the director and CEO of the Minnesota Historical Society, and I appreciate the opportunity to offer a few comments on the report. And as you may see from looking at the report and the table of contents, there is a letter from us that's included in the report. I think it's the last appendix. We've been pleased to oversee the State Historic Preservation Office for 49 years, and we believe that the office has performed high quality work for that nearly half century that it's been housed with us. It successfully completed tens of thousands of reviews, and in a given year now, about 3,000 reviews flow through the office without incident. And thousands of historic properties in the state of Minnesota have been listed on the National Register of Historic Places through SHPO. We've overseen millions of public and private dollars that have been invested in historic properties through state and federal historic rehabilitation tax credits, preserving significant historic structures and contributing to economic development. And importantly, many Minnesotans have been engaged in historic preservation efforts throughout the state through the work of this office and literally hundreds of local heritage and preservation groups around the state. And, of course, we're disappointed that a detailed and thorough performance analysis was not completed before the legislation was passed. But, you know, the legislature and the governor have taken this action, and our efforts for the last many months have been to work diligently with the Department of Administration, which is a partner that we've worked with on many things, including the state capitol restoration, to ensure that the high quality of service delivered by the excellent staff at the State Historic Preservation Office will continue through this transition. And it's February 28th. The transition is nigh upon us, and I think it has gone very smoothly, and we look forward to continue to provide whatever support we can.
Thank you, Mr. Elliott. At this time, members, I'm going to open it up to questions. I've got Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this might be for Mr. Nobles. But thank you for your testimony, Mr. Elliott, nonetheless.
You can stay there, though, Mr. Elliott.
Mr. Nobles, just briefly, I haven't had a chance to read through the report. I think it just came out. Where does SHPO belong in most of the other states throughout the country? Is it typically executive branch, or is it more like an arrangement that had been? So I'm just trying to get a sense of how unique this transition is.
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, Representative Johnson and members, if you turn to page 19, we do have some information on where SHPOs are in other states. And this can be a little bit confusing. Kind of depends on your source. We use several different sources to come up with this characterization of where SHPOs are organized. I think just to say in general, they are typically in the executive branch with very few exceptions. But on the other hand, in some executive branch, in the executive branch of some states, they are in a department that is very much a historical society. I mean, not every state has, like we have, a private nonprofit organization as a historical society. Some states actually create their own state agency as a historical society, and they put their SHPO there. I would say it might be a little unusual to put a SHPO in a Department of Administration, which has such a wide variety of functions. They mow the lawn, they paint the walls, they do a lot of different things. Now, I would say that some years ago, you did put the state archaeologist in the Department of Administration, and that's where it has functioned for a number of years. So it sort of seems like over the years that when you have something that doesn't fit anywhere else, you put it in the Department of Administration, and you have the commissioner here, and he can tell you for himself what kind of workload that puts on folks at the department. But this is the best source I could find. Representative Johnson, I would just say also that 1966 Historic Preservation Act itself seemed to suggest that a state historic preservation office would be under the direction of somebody appointed by the governor. Now, you know, in the legislature back shortly after the Historic Preservation Act was enacted, had that choice. You could have left it to the governor. Many of you weren't here then, I realize. But that legislature decided to, again, as I said, turn this function over to the Historical Society. And Mr. Elliott is himself, under the law, designated to be the state's, at least until March the 15th, the state's historic preservation officer.
March 1st.
March, I'm sorry, what did I say?
Tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow. I've got to give you a few more days. So that's kind of a long answer, but the best source of information is on page 19 for those of you who would like to pursue that. And I don't know if, Mr. Elliott, you certainly interact with many SHPOs around the country, so you might want to add.
No, I think that's good description. If one looks at the 58 state historic preservation offices out of the 59 entities in the country, a little more than a third are with state historical agencies. But as Mr. Noble said, in many states, the Historical Society is a state agency, and a little less than a third are in DNRs. So it's, you know, it's complicated in terms of, you know, the relationship of the Historical Society to the state. And, you know, but those are the two most prevailing templates.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I asked this first question because I don't know the exact number. I had heard of a number of complaints, but in their letter of rebuttal in the report, Mr. Nobles, the Historical Society said that there have been very few complaints. And I know that you always collect your data before you go out and do these studies. Would you maybe run through some of the types of complaints that we heard? And Mr. Elliott, you can feel free to answer as well. But I had heard quite a few and very loudly. I'm just trying to figure out what other ones were there.
Mr. Nobles?
Madam Chair, Representative Nash, and members, I did only focus on the major two that were cited. I did look at other projects. For example, I went over to the Historical Society and took several days to sit and look through a lot of Section 106 files. And there are a lot of them. And as Mr. Elliott said, typically they go through pretty smoothly. Often there are no effects or certainly no adverse effects that have to be dealt with. I think one of the significant things, and we seem to always come back to PolyMet, although I did mention the Chippewa project as well, but we seem to always come back to PolyMet as the one that loomed the largest in the criticism. And I think we all recognize that that is, in and of itself, for a lot of reasons, a very complicated, very controversial project. And so I think that got the most attention in terms of the criticism. But Representative Nash, I did talk to a lot of people who've had a lot of interaction with Section 106 reviews around the country, in Minnesota and elsewhere. And I think many of them said that SHPO staff does a great job. They're very dedicated and hardworking. But they could stand to have more accountability and oversight and maybe some exposure to people who are the stakeholders in these projects. I didn't mention it, but I will now, that I make a few recommendations to the Commissioner of Administration as he takes over this responsibility. And one of them is that I think it would be helpful for the commissioner and for the SHPO staff to make sure that they apply maybe a little bit of modesty in exercising this authority that they have. I think there were people who felt they came down in some of these other projects with a pretty heavy hand and were pretty directive towards people on what they had to do to get approval from SHPO. Again, I have a great deal of respect for the work that they do, the technical expertise that they bring. But you're talking about people who are trying to get a project done, and time is money. And when CHPO is not responding expeditiously, not making decisions as quickly as need to be made in some of these projects, you have project developers out there who are saying, could we just move this along? I mean, if you're going to say I have to do something to moderate an adverse effect, just tell me so I can start working on it. So we heard complaints about speed, about the fact that they do not have an adequate computer system, that most of the submissions have to be made on paper. So there were a variety of complaints. But I would say I heard a lot of concerns. Possibly those concerns could have been solved without the transfer. Again, being a little more modest, a little less heavy-handed, listening to people outside your realm of work, being a little more sympathetic to people you're affecting, but you did the transfer, and it needs to go forward. Another one of the recommendations I make is that the Commissioner of Administration assemble a group of stakeholders to advise him or her, to hear other voices about what impact CHPO is having. And I make other recommendations as well. But again, I made kind of a long answer to your question. But there were concerns that I heard across the board from a lot of people who had a lot of different experiences with CHPOs.
Mr. Elliott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a great question, and thanks for the chance to speak to that. Maybe about 4 points. First, I hope that you all will appreciate that when you have a great project that you want to do and you have to go through a review process, that's not something everybody loves to do. But the process is there for good reasons. And folks that do a lot of development projects not only know the process, but they know the Secretary of Interior guidelines that guide the sorts of responses and advice that we provide. And for those that don't do this all the time, to learn that there is a process and that there are certain standards that guide what you can do on the project comes as something of a surprise. And we work with both of them. We have worked with both of those. And to reach a successful conclusion. But, you know, this is not the sort of thing that makes people happy to go through. And there are incorporated in the process guidelines for response. And when we review our guidelines for response, we've done really well in terms of responding. For example, you respond within 30 days. And in most of those 3,000 cases, in more than 99% of those 3,000 cases, we respond within 2 weeks. And in those that handful of more complicated projects, we have consistently responded within the guidelines. And when we've looked back as a part of this review at our response record, it was excellent in terms of response. I think I would say about the degree to which the office has indicated to people what needs to be done to avoid or mitigate. In most cases, people want specificity because it helps the process move faster than for them just to keep submitting things that don't get, a full response. And so a part of that is trying to be helpful, actually, because people want to know, what are the Secretary of Interior guidelines mean when it comes to windows or original elements that are too are at this point too fragile to actually restore? Those sorts of questions. And you become accustomed to sensing, here's what would work without really telling people. I think another thing to understand about the process is that SHPO is in a consulting role. The drivers of the schedules are the federal agencies. But we're the local agent that can have the finger where the finger can be pointed most conveniently if someone is frustrated. But in cases where federal agencies are responsible for setting up phone calls and reviews and making sure the right parties are on the phone calls and have the material in front of them so they can be a productive, that's the responsibility of the federal agency. And if that's not done well there, despite our help and prompting, the frustration tends to be directed at the State Historic Preservation Office. That was certainly at play in the PolyMet case. Just two final things much more briefly. When there is frustration, it's important to understand what specifically the frustration is about so you can act on it. And we've tried to be attuned to constructive criticisms and frustrations so that we can be more responsive and help move things along. I'll give you an example of one case where I heard an organization, people in the community told me, well, so-and-so has had trouble with SHPO in getting the project approved. So I went to the chief operating officer. I said, this is what I've heard. Tell me about it. And he said, the problem is not with SHPO. SHPO's been very helpful. Our architect did not steep himself in the guidelines so that the plans that we had would meet the guidelines. We come up for review. They're not going to work. Your staff was very helpful in working with us to understand what needed to be done, and we went back, rethought, had new plans, and it went through. So sometimes you got to dig a little deeper on the criticisms. And I just would lastly say, and I appreciate Mr. Noble's mentioning the need for investment in technology in the office. This is something that we had on our radar and we hadn't gotten to yet, and I am delighted that with the move last year you put some money in that would enable the office and the Department of Administration to go ahead and tackle this right away, because it's needed. For the office to continue to function effectively, the Department of Administration will need to invest in technology. I'm sorry for the long-winded answer, but thanks for the chance to follow up. Respond.
One follow-up, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this will be for Commissioner, if you would mind joining us at the table.
I'm going to have you hold off on that question then.
Okay.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is relative to the fiscal note that was prepared in the Senate. I don't know if that would be appropriate at this time, or you would rather wait if somebody else is going
to
come up.
Is it pertaining to Department Admin, Mr. Elliott, or Mr. Nobles?
Well, basically, there's a large difference between what's being spent now compared to what will be spent in administration. I just wanted to see why.
Yeah, let's save that for a little bit. Representative Quam, do you have a question for Mr. Nobles or Mr. Elliott?
Yes, indeed, Madam Chair.
Representative Quam.
Mr. Nobles, I'm curious. There's a lot of discussion back and forth about, well, we've got this example of something that took an extensive amount of time, and then other people say, well, we've got examples of wonderful things. Was there any correlation to the types of projects and groups involved and how quickly it got through the process versus, you know, like the brakes were on, and then probably offline to get information comparative to other states on similar types of projects so I can understand they've got a different structure in these five states and it works better, these states it works worse, and that might help us understand where Minnesota sits in the process. But, yes, if you could go to the original question of, these projects associated with these groups go really well. These other ones are stuck in the mud.
Mr. Nobles.
Madam Chair, Representative Klum and members, I think it is, as, and we agree, it's the big complicated projects And maybe being operated by people, the PolyMed project, I'm sure they anticipated. And this is a project that has been going on a very long time with a lot of investment of a lot of money. And so the folks are eager to start mining, but they knew they were going to have to jump through the environmental hoops, get a lot of permits to mine from both federal and state. I don't know that they anticipated that they were going to have to go through the 601 historic preservation, and I don't know that they had people who were versed in how to get through that process. So I think as we compare either from Minnesota to other states or projects within Minnesota, we need to make sure that we've got a group of them that are similar enough that the comparison makes sense. So, again, I think there are many factors that can complicate a review, and I think all of those factors came into play on the PolyMed project.
Representative Kwan?
And could I just add, Madam Chair, I just want to make sure everybody knows that within the report, and I apologize that you haven't really had it time enough to get through it, but I did want to really be fair to both sides, the critics and the SHPO. And so when you look, starting on page 10, I have those two projects, the PolyMed project. I have the criticism of PolyMed, and I interviewed them, and I understand what their concerns were. But I also have on page 12, in some detail, what I heard from SHPO, and you just heard a summary of that from Mr. Elliott, of why it took the time it took. And I did the same thing on the Chippewa case. I have the criticism that was made of SHPO, and then I have a response from SHPO as to why they were as directive in that project as they were. And frankly, I didn't try to come to a conclusion about who's right and who's wrong. On, you know, you hear from both sides. And I think more than anything, the conflict is created out of the fact, particularly on PolyMed, that you have people with very different interests, very different perspective, very different goals, very different missions. PolyMet wants to get a mine in the ground, and they've spent tens of millions of dollars to get there and many years. And they are frustrated and eager to get going. And along comes SHPO saying, well, here's another set of hoops you need to run through. But SHPO says, yeah, because we're mandated under federal law to do what we're doing, and you can't get around these hoops. And in fact, the federal agencies are the ones that are deciding you got to go through these hoops.
Okay, Representative Kwan.
Madam Chair, as a general rule, it's nice to have any correlating factors that are, and commonalities between things that work well and things that don't, and then best practices comparative to other states and other systems that we can better understand and compare outside of a vacuum.
All right. Representative Flanagan, to these two individuals. Okay. Representative Flanagan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question. I know that this instance in particular, as we're dealing with the federally recognized Minnesota Ojibwe bands, I'm wondering what role that played in this process. And if, you know, we're looking at there's nation-to-nation conversations that are happening, I anticipate that that caused this project to look and maybe take a different amount of time.
Madam Chair, I think that's an excellent point, and one I probably should have made because it is another factor in the PolyMed project. And I think I also need to, again, direct you to a place in the report about who participates under the law, under the federal law, who is mandated to have an opportunity to participate. And the federal law really says to federal agencies, you have to have a government-to-government relationship with any of the tribes that are affected by this project. And so it's mandatory. And obviously, we have a number of tribes in this state. There were three federally recognized bands that were affected. There were three sites within the PolyMet project that were designated as culturally and religiously significant to those bands, and so they had to be part of the consultation. So, yes, And I hate to call it a complicating factor because it makes it sound like a bad thing. These were important sites to these bands of cultural and religious significance. And, again, I think the folks at SHPO felt like they needed to be advocates for the tribes in this case. They were up against a really big, powerful mining company, and the SHPO folks said, you know, there are some sites here that really have to be taken into consideration.
And may I add
Mr. Elliott.
Briefly, please? Thank you, Madam Chair. And in this case, there was a point in the process of not just being advocate for the tribe, but making sure the process is working. And there was a point in the process where I had to alert people to the fact that these tribes were not feeling that they had been adequately consulted. And I said, we don't want to get all the way through this process and then have this come up. We've seen how that's played out in other places. Would you please consult with the tribes as the process is you're responsible for doing? And a couple weeks were taken for that to happen. The tribes were very appreciative. It changed the memorandum of understanding about what would be done. Much better that that happens mm-hmm. during the process than at the end of the process.
Representative Flanagan.
Thank you. I just also, so thank you for that. That's, Madam Chair, thank you for that. That's helpful, especially as we know that we have Executive Order 1310, which tells us as a state government an entity that we must do consultation with the tribes. And I think too often that is overlooked. So I appreciate both of you just shedding a little bit of light on that. Thank you.
Okay, I have some questions, Mr. Elliott. A couple of things. Just first off, as this was progressing with these two projects, they seem to be kind of the outliers on it. How, who from the governor's office contacted you expressing concerns? Were there any lawmakers that contacted you expressing concerns about SHPO office?
The primary contact for me was Chief of Staff Tencher. I think there were other members of the governor's staff that worked with staff at SHPO. And we did talk from time to time about this with the representative and the senator from northern Minnesota.
And, Mr. Elliott, did they contact you to say we're recommending moving this office from Historical Society, or did they contact you to say, hey, we have some concerns, can you address these?
As I recall, and as we've had our routine meetings with them, they expressed hearing concerns about the project, and but seemed to indicate that they were being more responsive to the governor's concerns about its placement outside the executive branch as opposed to anything else.
And when you received those concerns, what was your response?
I was concerned. I mean, we want to do good work, and we want others to understand the work that we're doing. If we are doing something that we can do better, we want to do that. If it's a matter of helping people understand what the process is and what's going on, we want to do that too. So I think that I and our staff listened and tried to be as responsive as we could within our roles in the process.
Okay. I'll probably talk to you offline a little bit more about that. I'm also curious, too, looking just kind of at the financials piece, I had asked for your staff to provide me with how much of this chunk of your office is actually SHPO. So how many staff, what's the budget, and so forth, and I understand you've been in negotiations with the Department of Administration. Can you talk to me about the numbers side of things?
Yes. So the office's budget consists of about $950,000 in federal funds, nearly $300,000 in income that come from tax credit fees, and then about $250,000 in from the state appropriation general funds, appropriation state general funds. So the office overall is about $1.5 million. The exact count of positions is about 12, 14, 14 positions are paid for out of that budget.
Okay, and Mr. Elliott, is that the for the 14 staff, are they the ones that are going to go then to?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
And some of those are vacant positions right now, but yes, all the existing staff that do ship over work are moving, as well as funding for the vacant positions.
And of those staff, do you have a person that's in charge of kind of overseeing the overall operation?
Oh, yes, yes. The Deputy State Historic Preservation Officer, Amy Spong, oversees the office, and she will transfer to Department of Administration. And we have worked with the Department of Administration to agree on the amount of the state general operating funds that will transfer, so that we'll cover these direct costs as well as some indirect allocation.
So, Mr. Elliott, is that transfer amount the general fund dollars that you're speaking of, the $250,000?
No, it's going to be $325,000 to recognize indirect costs as well.
And what do you mean by indirect costs?
So that would be an allowance for space costs, utilities, service from other units like HR, IT, et cetera, you know, that kind of overhead.
It does include IT, you said?
In our calculation, yeah. The DOA has a different set of overhead calculations, but we, yes.
Okay. I think that's it for Representative Kunesh Podine for these two. Okay. Yep.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one more question to follow up on Representative Flanagan's question. You said there were three historic sites on the PolyMet, in the PolyMet situation. Were those adequately addressed and surveyed? Has that been completed?
Yes.
Mr. Elliott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, that's been addressed. So the sites were identified, and then in conversation with the tribes for their sites, there was another site that was not related to Native Americans. There was agreement on what would be done to avoid or mitigate damage to the site. So, for example, in terms of access to sugar bush, how that would be accommodated. All of those understandings are part of the memorandum of agreement that all the parties signed at the end. So that agreement is now in place. It'll be the work of parties to make sure that the obligations that are a part of the agreement are executed.
Great. Thank you.
Kunesh. Okay. All right. For now, if you guys want to step aside, we'll have the commissioner come, but don't go too far. Commissioner, welcome to the committee. And I see you brought a friend with. And if you could please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Madam Chair and members, Commissioner Mossman, Department of Administration. With me is Assistant Commissioner Kurt Yoakum, who will be overseeing this for the Department of Administration as it transfers in.
Thank you, Commissioner. I think that we have a couple members that have questions for you. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question, and then Representative Vogel and I had the same question, so I'll pass it off to him. Mr. Elliott talked about some money that will be allocated or spent for a technological upgrade, and of course, you know, that makes my heart soar like a hawk. So I'm wondering what sort of an expected reduction in labor that you'll have relative to this technology upgrade to doing the SHPO piece that you'll be inheriting, I guess, in a day, if you would.
Commissioner.
Madam Chair and Representative Nash, thank you for the question, because it gives me an opportunity to further articulate a few things. The short answer to your question is none in the short term. So that would certainly be, I think, one of the fantastic opportunities over the long term is to find efficiencies, and I think for the front-end processes, and as Director Elliott mentioned, there certainly are a lot of opportunities for digitization of records and for the interaction that has to happen being less paper-driven between the State Historic Preservation Office and the stakeholders as part of the process. I would just a couple things related to the IT cost to be clear. There is nothing being assumed in the budget transactions that are happening as part of this transfer between the Department of Administration and the Historical Society that accounts for the much-needed or makes room for the much-needed investment in new technology. The only thing that is being considered is that obviously people have computers on their desks, and those computers hook up to a network, and occasionally they might have to call a help desk for help, and so that there's a certain amount of day-to-day support and IT that is an indirect cost, nothing for new investment. I would also bring you back to the conversation from last legislative session. Obviously, as we had that, as this legislation was going forward last year, and there was a small amount of money that was appropriated to the Department of Administration as part of this transfer in the tails going forward. And we will certainly, that conversation was very much an awareness that we knew that we needed to look at technology and be preparing for and planning for investment, but it was not in any way anticipated to be the amount that might eventually be needed for an investment.
Representative Nash?
I want to be clear, there was never any testimony on my part or the part of the department that $200,000 was going to solve the technology issues, but we believe that we can certainly make progress on some of the paper digitization and that sort of thing going forward.
Representative Nash?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess on the 1st or 2nd, you'll have those folks working for you. And is it 13? 13.
It's 14.
So, and it sounds like they're a pretty scrappy group and that they're doing good work, but so I appreciate that. I'm going to expect that there's going to be some advancements in the ability to do more work with fewer people as a result of technology. But I know that Representative Vogel is going to ask the second half of my question, so, Madam Chair, I'll be done.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I went back on the fiscal note. There was a fiscal note prepared by the Senate, not by the House, as I understand it. So I'm working off of theirs, but it appears as if we're going from 10.26 FTEs to 20.15 in that fiscal note. Now, I don't know if you probably don't have it in front of you, but I would assume you're familiar with it because it was prepared as part of the legislation. So I guess my curiosity is how come we're doubling employees? What's happening?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think there's an easy answer to that question. First of all, the fiscal note, as you might imagine, was prepared as it needed to be on a timely basis last legislative session, but with really what I think would be best characterized as preliminary conversations and knowledge sharing between the Historical Society and the Department of Administration at that time. So I believe there are 20-some employees in the current State Historic Preservation Office approximately at the Historical Society. They are not all moving over to the Department of Administration. Some of them have responsibilities for administering legacy grants and some other functions. So that fiscal note was put together on the premise that at the time, without further information and analysis, that all of the employees would be moving over to the department, and that's not what's happening. So there's 14 employees, so the FTE count is substantially different from what that fiscal note was premised on.
Well, I'm going to phone a friend on that. Ms. Roberts, is that in reading the fiscal note, is that what we're seeing in this? Because that was not my interpretation. Do you know or no?
Madam
Chair, am I putting you on the spot?
Yes, you are.
And I won't.
I actually do have a question, and I don't think all members have the fiscal note. I think part of when you look at the FTE going from 9.9 to 20.15, the Historical Society is showing a change only in fiscal year 2018, a negative change, and that's not carrying forward into the out years, and that would make up the difference, but since I didn't prepare the fiscal note, I'm not sure why that is.
Is it from the whole department that carries it?
No.
So from the heritage of the bird, I don't think you understand that.
Madam Chair, okay.
Yeah, again, and I, you know, I'll just to give some context, the way the historical society is organized, and they really would be, I think, better positioned to answer some of the questions that you're asking than I would be or my team would be. There's the way the department of the departments are organized within the historical society is that they have a broader Office of Historic Preservation Department within the society, which has 30-some employees, and SHPO is only part of that operation within the Heritage Preservation Department. And then even within the SHPO functions, within the State Historic Preservation Office, the way it is currently organized and the functions that are currently assigned to it, not all of those responsibilities in the Historical Society relate directly to the federal Section 106 process or the other state law-related requirements around historic preservation. So in the end of the day, with the hindsight of the 9 months that we've been working with the Historical Society cooperatively, I might point out, Director Elliott and his team and my team and Minute Services have been working very collaboratively together on understanding what needs to happen here for this to be a smooth transition. Not all of those FTE and all of that workload will move over to the Department of Administration.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So follow up. Well, the fiscal note said 10.26. It didn't say 14. So my assumption was that hopefully that MMB, when they look at these things, are spending some time in reviewing them and would have come up with an accurate answer because, you know, the legislation was prefaced on that. So I'd hate to think that the fiscal notes that we're getting aren't accurate.
If I could ask, where on the fiscal note, do you have a page number?
Well, it's right on the first page of the one that was given to the Senate. It says consolidated fiscal. I don't have a date on it. I don't know.
And Madam Chair?
And is that only the general fund positions, if I could ask? I'm sorry, because I think if you turn to page 3 of the fiscal note, which is the Department of Administration's estimate, again, at that time, you'll see that the FTE count.
Can I pause you just a second,
yes,
here, Commissioner? For members' sake, we are getting you copies of the fiscal note because I understand not all of you have them, and some of us just kind of decided to do some extra work. So,
excellent.
Sorry.
And Madam Chair, just to, you know, it was my understanding, just for the record, that you were wanting some insight on how the transition was going, and so I'm happy to talk about whatever questions you want to talk about today.
Yes, but this is kind of part of the transition.
We're refreshing ourselves on the fiscal note. On page 4 of the fiscal note, you will see Representative Vogel a reference to 20.15 FTE, which aligns with my testimony to this point.
Representative Vogel.
Okay, well, I apologize for going into an area where people don't have the same information because we're working off of a Senate fiscal note rather than the House fiscal note, and I realize that. My concern is that basically it was saying that there's going to be $1 million more spent to have this in the Department of Administration rather than it cost in the Historical Society. And that's obviously a lot of that is driven by people, and that's why looking at the fiscal note on the front of it, I realize they go away in 1920 and 21 because they won't be there. But the same amount of people are there for administration, 20.15. Now, basically, you know, that there's 9.9 more coming out of the general fund for some reason. And rather than get into that, maybe if we can't because you don't have that information, I guess part of it was, as you go to page 6, about one-third of the way down, it says, based on consultation with Minute, you're going to need 2 FTEs, and with everything else, it's going to come to $530,320 each year to Minute. And I guess this is what really drew my attention and looking at the numbers here is, and that doesn't talk about the replacement of the software because that's on page 7, talking about another $300,000 annually to upgrade the software. So my concern is that we've already got problems with IT in a number of different areas. Now we're going to move this thing over from Historical Society to administration, and if fiscal notice proper, we're going to spend over $500,000 on IT, and that's why I drew the attention to the $1 million in additional spending. Are we really starting to employ a lot more dollars toward IT in minute here, or where's that money going, that extra $1 million that's coming out of the general fund relative to what was happening in the general fund when Historical Society had it?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair and Representative Vogel, you know, I think I'm just going to suggest that perhaps the best way to proceed with this conversation, and I'm happy to talk about the fiscal note if that's what we want to go, but the fiscal note at this point really is 10 or 12 months old based on a speculative transition, and those are not the, it's not going to cost $1 million more. I think we've had a lot of conversation in working out where this is going to go going forward. So what I can tell you is that there's going to be 14 positions moving over. The resources that will be moving over from the Historical Society to the Department of Administration are the resources related to those 14 positions directly. The federal grant fundings that are related to those positions. Now I would just, so there's no additional $1 million that we're going to spend on this money. That was on this function whatsoever or on IT. I think it's really more relevant to talk about not what was estimated and projected based on an uncertain number of FTE, but now that we are implementing the law, as of tomorrow, what is it that we're actually going to be doing? And I can assure you that there's not going to be an additional $1 million a year or anything close to, or as far as I'm aware, any additional monies spent on this function.
Representative Vogel?
Okay, well, thank you, Madam Chair. Well, yeah, I guess at this point I have questions as far as the accuracy of fiscal notes, if indeed this was the reason that the legislation was passed with a fiscal note, but that's not your fault. My hope would be that maybe we can get some follow-up information, because if I'm assured that it's not going to cost any more to do it in one place than the other, that was my question, is looking at this, why would it cost more in one area than it would cost in another area? So if we're being assured that the cost will be equal, then I'm fine with it. Thank you.
And, Madam Chair, if I could, just to that, to point out a few things, because I think it may very well be relevant for the conversation going forward, and we can certainly provide you more articulation on this. But to just add a bit to Director Elliott's numbers that were shared earlier, it's my understanding that of the 14 positions that are moving over, the dollar amounts that were shared by Director Elliott relate to 11 of those positions. So three positions have been vacant for a period of time. And so those are positions that are required by federal law. And so we will be filling those. So they're around the edges. I think that there's just a more holistic picture that we could bring forward to you. In addition to the fact that costs like space costs and things like that, the Historical Society actually funds them separately. So they're not from an accounting structure in their SHPO function. They just pay for them generally out of a general bucket of money. So there is, just to have some apples to apples comparison from an accounting perspective, as when we budget at the Department of Administration, every single unit kind of covers their space costs and we attribute it to them. That's just different from how the Historical Society has done it. Neither one is right or wrong. It's just different. And so it takes a little massaging to have an apples to apples comparison.
Well, that's not the understanding that I had. So, Mr. Elliott, can you join us a little bit here at the table? So it's my understanding in the negotiations with the Department of Administration in this whole transition that it was going to be for the full 14 FTEs, and you're saying now that it's only for the 11 that it was negotiated out.
No, it is.
Go ahead, Commissioner.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I didn't mean to. I apologize for that. It is for the 14 positions. I just think the dollar amounts that Director Elliott, and he's here, he can speak for himself, that he was referring to some general fund appropriations at the Historical Society that go into SHPO. I think that reflects that they only have 11 positions that are funded right now. I think that there's a potential that they would be spending more if the all 14 positions were filled.
Okay, well, then that what I'm looking for is the breakdown of the dollars. So we're making this transition. Right now, so far, what I've got on my sheet is $950,000 of the federal dollars coming in. I've got $300,000 in the tax credit fees coming in. I've got $250,000 in the general fund. But I don't think that that number is accurate because later on we heard 325, and I assume that's from the general fund for transfer indirect costs. So tell me what the numbers are. And, Mr. Elliott, you got your hand raised?
Yes. So the 245 from the state general funds is the portion without indirect costs. We're actually transferring $325,000 to cover that. But I think, if, do you mind if I turn around and ask my finance person something here?
By all means.
Ann, are we transferring funding for 14, our funding for 14 positions? Yes, but
she's welcome to come down and speak if that is helpful too. And same with Commissioner, if you've got the numbers.
I'm not sure that the funds that we have allocated for those 14 positions that we're transferring will necessarily fund those positions. You know, that's what we pay to fund those positions. If we're transferring that plus indirect, I think the cost in the Department of Administration may be a little higher to fund the positions.
So, Commissioner, help me out. Why,
I don't know whether this is going
to... Why would it be higher coming from Historical Society going to admin? Is there certain things that you do differently for the employees? Or?
Yeah, I think, Madam Chair, and I what might be best is for us to get you an itemized sheet, so because right. I can imagine a situation where we could be talking in circles here, and I think that there's a way to do this, if that's your request and the committee's request, to make this more straightforward. Happy to do that. In short, if there's any adjustments at all, it's marginal. I would say there's obviously the individuals impacted, and I would just point out that, you know, I think to the credit of Steve's team and my team, one of the things that we've been very cognizant of throughout this whole process, and it really has been collaborative, is that there's individuals who are impacted by this, and to be really thoughtful about the process. And the positions that are coming in, because they are not currently state employees at the Historical Society, they have, you know, there's a Hay assessment. They have to be compared. And there's not necessarily a lot of positions like them in state government. I believe it's like $10,000 or $20,000. It's a marginal difference just figuring out where people come in, but it's for the most part the costs are really roughly the same for the positions coming in, and it certainly is it differs by position. Some are coming in, I think, almost exactly at what they are at the Historical Society. Some have a little bit difference.
Okay. I think getting the numbers would be very helpful because we're looking at, you know, what does this transition mean for this committee in particular. I know that in the comments from the governor's office that the whole reason for this transfer from the Historical Society to the Department of Administration, I'm quoting from the auditor's report, it says to reduce inefficiency and improve accountability. So I would assume that this is going to, in essence, cost us less at the end of the day. And I'm glad, Commissioner, that you confirmed that this is not going to cost us more dollars than what it would have been if it had stayed housed in the Historical Society. I think that's helpful. And I think that that gives us a guidance moving forward as far as this funding piece, too. So.
Madam Chair, I appreciate that. And for the record, because I do want to be continuously transparent with you, I did say that the current operations, I believe, will be essentially the same cost in the executive branch as they were in the Historical Society, as best we can tell from the budget information we have from the department. I've also said that I believe over time there will need to be some additional technology investment in the functions of the State Historical Preservation Office in order to be operating at the level that I think that stakeholders in the business community and elsewhere across the state expect to see from the office.
Okay. All right. I got Representative Vogel and then Representative Johnson.
Just one thing, Madam Chair. If indeed when we get the accounting on page 6, the paragraph that starts with based on consultation with Minute and referring to the $530,320 each year, if we could get really good clarification on what that meant in the fiscal note. I don't want to belabor it here because we're going to go around circles, but as long as we're getting an accounting, that would really be helpful to see why that was put in the fiscal note.
Yeah, and I think the more detailed that it can be from both of you, I think that would be the most helpful, who these individuals are, what their responsibilities are, and so forth. Okay?
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to complain about not having a fiscal note that you were discussing, but now we have it, so I won't do that. But to the extent that we can obviously get it ahead of time, our side or everybody, I guess.
I think there's just a couple of us that went above and beyond. It's so.
Okay.
But yes. Yeah.
Any event, I like to look at stuff ahead of time, too, but
certainly.
Vogel always asks good questions down there, so.
Representative Olson.
I think we've had a, thank you, Madam Chair, a good conversation about some of what was speculated in the past and talking about the fiscal note. But I actually didn't read a lot other than what was mentioned by Chair Anderson about this being a fiscal conversation in terms of why it got transferred. I heard much more in reading these recommendations is about clarifying the role in the Section 108 part, you know, a deeper understanding from the Department of Admin on how to handle SHPO and having to get yourselves up to speed on some things you probably weren't within your purview before, that now are going to be within your purview of how you actually manage and give direction to SHPO. You need to study the federal law and regulations that govern historic preservation, which is sort of a new bit to some degree, probably. So I'd love to have some conversation about, hearing from the commissioner about some of these new things you're going to be doing that maybe are going to fall outside of just the SHPO staff coming over. It sounds like your staff that are outside of those 14 are going to have to gain some expertise, some ability to interface with these 14 people that may impact some of the fiscal question and other pieces of having run offices before and managed people. When you bring in 14 people, they don't work in a vacuum. They're going to touch other parts of your staff. So I think you're getting at understanding the spirit of my question here around
absolutely
probably this number 3 recommendation bullet point.
Commissioner?
So, Madam Chair and Representative, thank you for the question. And let me just start off by, again, acknowledging the work of the legislative auditor, Mr. Nobles, and I have had several conversations about this, and I fully agree with and support the recommendations, and I think that they will be very helpful and that this report will be a very helpful basis for us to work from going forward. So I think that that is all very positive. I think as far as the getting up to speed and integrating this function into the Department of Administration, it is clear from our work that there is some really dedicated, passionate experts in the State Historic Preservation Office, and we look forward to working with them. I think that it is important to expand a bit on, understanding that my recollection, certainly, of the conversation that evolved last legislative session was certainly less to do. I don't recall much conversation about government efficiency so much as there was a concern about, as is I think well laid out in Auditor Noble's report, about the work of the SHPO office. So it wasn't a government efficiency question, and I'm not weighing in one side or another on the merits. I just think that there is it's important to understand. We take that feedback very seriously, and I think that there will be some opportunities to build on that. My final thing just to point out would be, while we do a fantastic job of mowing the lawn and painting the walls, we also have a wide range of professionals at the Department of Administration who oversee $2.5 billion worth of procurement and contracting. Each year we oversee all of the real estate leasing and real property transactions on the part of the state. We oversee construction services, supplier diversity programs, the state demographer, and a host of other functions, including, frankly, the state archaeologist and some other functions that are oftentimes aligned, meaning in the same agency as the Historic Preservation Office in other states. So I think that we're not starting with one hand tied behind with both hands tied behind our back. I think that there will be some real opportunities actually for synergies here going forward, and there's actually some alignment. There certainly is going to have to continue to be a continued working relationship with the Historical Society also, and with the collaboration of Director Elliott and his team, we've already entered into a memorandum of understanding just so that we will, as entities, have clarity about the functions of the Historic Preservation Office and the functions of the Historical Society and how those two entities can support each other. In the end of the day, there is an important federal and state. We've mostly been talking about the federal 106 process, but there's also state historic preservation responsibilities that also fall into this office. And so in the end of the day, I think that there's really important work that has to get done here. Historic preservation is obviously the responsibility of this office, and there's development work that happens around the state, and I think that there's a real important need to focus on that being and continuing to be good quality work going forward, and I have every bit of confidence that it will be.
Representative Detmer?
Yeah, it just brought to mind, will you be overseeing the renovation of the Fort Snelling, the historic Fort Snelling?
Commissioner?
Madam Chair, and that is the Historical Society project. Do we build your buildings?
No, but the State Historic Preservation Office will review our plans for the renovation of the two historic structures of Fort Snelling. We'll be a client. We'll be subject to review.
And we will treat them with every bit of respect that we do all of our stakeholders.
All right. Okay, so Commissioner, I'll have some additional questions for you. We can do that offline. I'm just quoting what the governor, his spokesperson, said, that this was about inefficiency, reducing inefficiency, improving accountability. So I want to see that happen. If we are moving it to your office, I want to see that is actually happening. And then also, I think for these purposes as well, I think that we'll have to keep tabs on this and kind of have a kind of update report after you get your feet under you a little bit more, too. And I look forward to getting the additional materials that you guys have and working from there. So, members, you'll get a chance to have your questions answered. And if you have any additional ones, please let us know so that we can forward those on to the commissioner and Mr. Elliott. Members, I think that is it for now, and appreciate you both coming in. We'll be in contact and go through some additional details.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Oh, I remember now what it was. I was delaying because I was trying to remember what it was. So I think it's point two or point three in Mr. Noble's report. I do think it would be helpful for us to have a group that has some oversight for this. I think that's a good recommendation. And if it's not on your docket of to-do list items, I would hope that you would include that as something that you're going
to do. Madam Chair, thank you. And it is actually already on our docket, so I appreciate that.
Great. Thank you. Thank you both. Oh, did Representative Ward, did you have a question? I apologize.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. No, I just as we were finishing, because we're going to be revisiting this, I intend to take it home and read it tonight. But should we then keep them in our notebooks, in our folders, so that we have them for next time, put them in the safe folder?
Representative Ward, that's an excellent idea. And then just so you know, too, Mr. Noble's, the website for the legislative auditor, they have them all posted, but it is easier if you just stick it in your safe folder. So, okay. All right. Thank you, everyone, for that. We don't have a whole lot of time, but we will at least get ourselves started on the OLA report on Metropolitan Transit.
And then what we will do is we will probably kick this to next week because we already have agenda items for tomorrow. So if we can at least get ourselves started in the 15 minutes that we have remaining, I'd appreciate it. Welcome to the committee. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. For the record, my name is Judy Randall. I'm the Deputy Legislative Auditor on OLA's Program Evaluation Division side, on the Program Evaluation side. I'm here to talk, and I can be pretty brief here, Madam Chair, about two reports that we released earlier in the fall. They look very similar. One was October 4th, one was November 30th, on transit financial activity. Last session, the legislature passed a law requiring our office to do financial reviews of transit activity every quarter. So these are the first two reports that we've issued, and we're working on our third. I'll mostly just focus on the first one we issued, which is dated October 4th. And really, overall, we didn't see significant problems with Metropolitan Council's Transportation Division's historical balance sheets. We thought the council had maintained adequate reserves in the past to allow them to adjust for variations in expenditures as they pop up. We had one area of concern, and this is how the Met Council reports its financial condition to the Federal Transit Administration as compared to how it reports its condition to the state legislature. And if I could direct your attention to, so again, the report dated October 4th, there are two tables in there, and I think that's just the easiest way to see where our concern is. On page 15 are the numbers that the Met Council reported to the federal government. It reported these numbers in June 2017. And then if you flip the page, unfortunately they're not on facing pages, on page 16 is the information the Met Council reported for its internal budgeting purposes and then also to the legislature. And these numbers show a different financial condition. Basically, the report that's provided to the federal government shows a healthier, shows a healthy fund balance, and it shows a healthier kind of overall balance sheet. The information provided to the state shows a deficit, a larger deficit. There are differences in the assumptions made underneath this reporting. There's a bunch of different assumptions. They rely on different time frames. They assume different costs about metro mobility. They include costs associated with suburban transit providers in the state version, but not in the federal version. And then the thing I think is the biggest issue is that to the federal government, they report their full reserve fund balance, and they don't report that to the state when they're talking to legislators about their financial condition. So our recommendation to the Met Council is just to provide some transparency around that. There's different sets of assumptions. They can explain to you why they use different assumptions. We're not saying one is correct and one is incorrect, but what we do think is important is for them to share with you the assumptions they use underneath each of those reports, explain the difference it makes, and then let you come to a judgment about whether you accept those assumptions or not, or whether you want to see the impact of different assumptions. That's really our report in a nutshell, Madam Chair. I'm happy to answer additional questions, but I think that sums it up.
Okay. I think we're going to do the same thing that we did the last time. Met Council folks, I've got Ms. Chermoff and Ms. Bogie, if you want to come to the table. And if you want to give your response to the OLA report. And just as a reminder, members, this was part of the state government finance bill. That's why we are discussing that here today. So welcome. If you can please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Good afternoon, Chair Anderson and committee members. For the record, my name is Aline Churimoff, and I am the chair of the Metropolitan Council. I want to thank you for the opportunity to respond to the OLA's report and comments just now. Since last summer, our finance staff have worked closely with the Office of the Legislative Auditor staff to provide them with information that they need to conduct their quarterly financial reviews. I want to make sure it's clear that we take the comments from the OLA very seriously. We all share the goal of ensuring the public funds are spent as they should be, and we agree that we should be transparent and accountable in our work. We appreciate the opportunity to work together with the OLA towards this common goal. We're encouraged by that the OLA found no significant problems in their review of the Council's historical balance sheets. We're also encouraged that they found the Council has maintained adequate reserves to adjust for variations in our transit revenues and expenses in both their second quarter and third quarter reviews. However, I do want to address the one specific matter that was just raised. In their second quarter review, the OLA highlighted perceived inconsistencies between the projections the Council provides to our federal partners when planning light rail lines and projections we provide to you, the legislature, as part of our biennial budget request. These documents do use different assumptions, and they are not meant to reconcile. On the federal side, we provide the federal government with a financial capacity assessment when we're planning for our light rail projects. The federal document referenced is called our financial capacity assessment, and we submit that to the Federal Transit Administration. The financial capacity assessment is a 20-year, well, it starts with a 10-year retrospective or a 10-year look back, and then a 20-year projection. And our federal partners use that to assess the financial health of our regional transit system. So basically, we look at the functions that are funded by state appropriations that we have received in the past, and we project those forwards as we expect to receive those in the future, and we expect to continue to receive funding for those in the future. And they use this information when the Federal Transit Administration is making decisions regarding the future investment in our transit system. This assessment is not based on current law or current conditions. It's based on historical funding trends and taking those historical funding trends and projecting those into the future. So basically, just kind of to put it more simply, it allows us to make projections about the future based on how they've been funded in the past. And it's also how the federal government expects us to provide this information to them. When we turn to the other set of assumptions, the set that you see as part of the budget process, we're looking at providing four-year projections. Those four-year projections are based on current law, current council policy, current service levels, and current revenue assumptions. So fares, general fund base appropriations, forecasted MVEST revenues, those are what are part of the four-year projections. And the council provides that information, or this information, as a way of informing the legislature of what our real and near-term budget position is prior to the legislative session. In the second quarter report from the OLA, the OLA recommended that in future reports to the legislature, the council should explicitly identify the assumptions that we use in different transportation financial plans and budget documents, and two, explain the impact that these assumptions have on the council's financial forecast. We appreciate this feedback, and we are more than prepared to incorporate those recommendations into future reports that we provide to the legislature. On a side note, Senator Osmak has a bill, SF-2752, that statutorily directs the council to provide that information. And the council testified that we would work with Senator Osmak on his bill. So I just want to close and just reiterate the fact that we're encouraged by the OLA's broader conclusions that the council has sound financial management and found no significant impacts, and we look forward to working closely with the OLA as they continue their quarterly reviews. Thank you.
Members, any questions? I am shocked. You did it. We do appreciate you working with us and just having the transparency of having both the reports. I think that is really helpful. So thank you for doing that.
Thank you.
And with that, I think we're good to go. So thank you. Members, we've got a couple things up on the docket tomorrow. I think we're discussing MNLARS.